McDonald Park. McDonald Park, along the shore of Lake Ontario and across from Kingston General Hospital, was the designated meeting place for the Mississaugas to receive their annual payment for the selling of their land in the Crawford Purchase. Each summer, they would assemble by canoe to collect cookware, clothing, and alcohol. The Mississaugas were the original residents of Cataraqui, settling along the shore of Lake Ontario and hunting for game inland. Initially, in the summer of 1783, Joseph Brant suggested to General Haldimand that there be no appeal to the Mississaugas for the land around Fort Frontenac, as it would undoubtedly require their given consent and inspire their claim to payment for their sacrifice. This is, however, exactly what happened. In the October 1783 Crawford Purchase, the elderly Chief Minas agreed to sell a portion of land in exchange for an annual payment of clothing, red cloth, silver, pots and pans, and alcohol, among other things. Each summer, the Mississaugas would assemble by canoe at McDonald Park, across from Kingston General Hospital, to receive their gifts. The title, Mississauga, designated by the French and other settlers, likely refers to the word Mississaki, meaning many river mouths. The Mississaugas believe that they acquired the name because of the numerous rivers which flow near and around their land, including Trent, Moira, Shannon, Napanee, Kingston, and Gananoque rivers. It was General Haldimand's impression that the Mississaugas appear much satisfied that the white peoples are coming to live among them. However, it is more likely that they were displeased with the extent of their land that was encroached upon, past the agreed-upon territory, and the general sense of disdain and disapproval that they felt from their new neighbors. One of the few documented encounters involving the Mississaugas comes from Mrs. Simcoe's diaries. She did not reflect favorably upon the nation. Mrs. Simcoe was the wife of Lieutenant Governor John Graves Simcoe, the first Lieutenant Governor of the Province of Upper Canada, 1792 to 1796. She made regular entries into her diary, noting her interactions and surroundings during her time in Cataraqui, among other places. In 1792, she first mentions her contempt for the Mississaugas. "There are Mississauga Indians here. They are an unwarlike, idle, drunken, dirty tribe. I observe how extremes meet. These uncivilized people saunter up and down the town all day with the apparent nonchalance, want of occupation, and indifference that seems to possess the London beau in Bond Street." The strong opinion portrayed in Mrs. Simcoe's diary was likely shared by others as well. It illustrates the broader division between European and indigenous cultures, cultures that had to exist in close proximity to one another in Cataraqui. Although it is apparent that Mrs. Simcoe saw little potential in the Mississaugas, they were evidently capable of religious reform and of improving their nation. The Mississaugas' Ojibwe chief and Methodist minister Peter Jones spoke in many communities in Upper Canada, attracting whites and natives alike. Among his various indigenous names, he was known in Mohawk as Desagundunsta, meaning "he stands people on their feet." His sermons were said to be instructional and inspirational, and they were likely responsible for the survival of the Mississaugas. At a time when the Mississaugas, among other Ojibwe bands, were on the verge of collapse, Peter Jones provided a focus on spirituality that proved to be deeply effective for the unity of the nation. Along with his brother, he is credited with completing one of the earliest translations of the Bible into Ojibwe, allowing for its accessibility and comprehension among the Mississaugas. Four Directions Aboriginal Student Center. The Four Directions Aboriginal Student Center, situated at 146 Berry Street on the edge of the Queen's University campus, strives to enhance and bring awareness to the Aboriginal experience in Canada, as well as educate about its heritage. The name, Four Directions, stems from the center's aim to provide resources that balance and strengthen four distinct avenues of well-being: academic, spiritual, emotional, and physical. Harmony among these four avenues is integral to the success of the Aboriginal student population at Queen's. The center's inclusion of resources for spiritual health has contributed heavily to its success, as spirituality is a significant and valued facet of Aboriginal culture. It is a facet, however, that is generally overlooked by other guidance options, which focus more on emotional and physical well-being and therefore fail to fully meet the needs of Aboriginal students. The center is proactive in addressing sensitive topics concerning Aboriginal issues or questions that may arise at Queen's. To ensure a seamless transition from Aboriginal culture to university life, information and guidance is readily available to both students and staff. An Aboriginal Council was established in 1992 to ensure that future generations of Aboriginal students had access to higher education at Queen's, and that measures were taken to educate faculty and staff on the broader issues faced by Aboriginal students. The Council, composed of Aboriginal representatives from communities in Ontario, Aboriginal student representatives at Queen's and senior university personnel, is directly involved in decisions affecting Aboriginal programs and services at Queen's. Additional events, such as the Symposium on Indigenous Research and the Powwow, have helped to create a more welcoming environment at Queen's, as well as to educate the larger population on Aboriginal culture, traditions, and history. Apart from the extensive information and guidelines available through Four Directions, the Centre also serves as a sanctuary for Aboriginal students on campus. A traditional teepee can be seen from Arch Street in the background of the centre, where talking circles, ceremonies, and teachings are shared. You may also find a student in the teepee studying, meditating, or relaxing. The centre also houses traditional ceremonies and gatherings, such as the Three Sisters Feast Night on Wednesday evenings and moon ceremonies, where female Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal students, staff, and community members seek guidance from Grandmother Moon, as well as renew their energy in ceremonial offerings to her. The centre supports all cultural groups of Aboriginal students in all four avenues of their well-being, especially their spirituality, as well as advocates for their needs to ensure that Queen's University and the surrounding community are responsive to the unique issues that they face. Earl Street. The story behind Kingston's Earl Street is an interesting one. It is a story that provides insight into the evolving social dynamics of the late 18th century. At this time, there was an emerging notion that sentimentality, equality, and respect between men and women should be guidelines for proper conduct, likely sparked by the philosophers of the era. Mm-hmm. Hugh Earl, for whom Earl Street was named, was a Scottish mariner who married Anne, the youngest daughter of Molly Brant and Sir William Johnson, in 1793 or 1794. Anne and Hugh likely wed for mutual and sincere love and devotion to one another, as it was a time which encouraged love as legitimate reason to marry, as opposed to previously arranged marriages. Unlike her mother, Molly Brant, who was devoted to living in accordance with her Mohawk traditions, Anne struggled to lead her predominantly European lifestyle while still honoring her Mohawk heritage. Indigenous peoples were made to feel degraded, judged, and devalued for their heritage, traditions, and dress. It is likely due to this feeling of disrespect and degradation that Molly Brant's daughters chose to identify more with the European culture that surrounded them in Cataraqui. Assimilation to the European culture was also something that was encouraged by their uncle and Mohawk chief, Joseph Brant. Anne married Captain Hugh Earl, who was known to be a gentleman and of good character. In 1812, he came to command the Provincial Marine in Lake Ontario, earning him the title of captain. Anne's mother, Molly Brant, who was clan mother of her Mohawk nation, and a common-law spouse, was afforded the freedom and independence that Anne, as a married woman, was not. At the time, the law did not recognize married women as independent beings. Anne's quality of life and independence was therefore entirely determined by her husband, but luckily he afforded her every freedom. St. George's Cathedral and Reverend John Stuart. Reverend John Stuart's contributions to the religious, educational, and social development of Kingston is undeniable. He was known to be, quote, a man of exemplary character, good understanding, and education, and one who had, quote, great influence with the Loyalists as well as the Indians. He was said to be a handsome man of Irish descent, well over 6 feet tall, and admired among his peers. He was good friends with both Molly and Joseph Brant, and is buried near Molly on the grounds of St. Paul's Church on Queen Street in Kingston, though the exact location is not known. Reverend Stuart was ordained in 1770 in London, England, and soon after, upon returning to New York, held services for both Indigenous peoples and white people at Fort Hunter. He was also appointed missionary to the Indians in Gunajoa Reggae, where he first met Joseph Brant. Brant lived with Reverend Stuart for a short period of time in the Mohawk parsonage near Fort Hunter after being widowed in 1771, losing his first wife of three. Around this time, they worked together to translate the New Testament into the Mohawk language, eventually printed in 1787. Near the end of the 1770s, Reverend Stuart's property in New York was ransacked, as was the case for many other Loyalists. His church was looted, and his life became so troublesome that he requested permission to leave. Eventually, in 1781, Reverend Stuart, along with his family, his wife, their first three sons, and their African slaves, were allowed to go to Quebec, where he held a job as a schoolmaster. It wasn't until 1785 that he settled in Cataraqui as a second-wave Loyalist. In Cataraqui, Reverend Stuart opened the first school west of the Ottawa River. It was originally run out of his home, but later in a government building. St. George's, an Anglican church, was the first of any denomination in Kingston and was founded by Reverend Stuart in 1792. Its original location, which is now marked by a plaque, was the former Whig Standard Building across from Market Square. It was a modest wooden structure at just 40 by 32 feet. Mrs. Simcoe, wife of Lieutenant Governor John Graves Simcoe, was very much impressed with the service at this new church, as evident from an entry in her diary. Quote, I went to church twice. The clergyman, Mr. Stewart, is from the United States. He preached good sermons with an air of serious earnestness in the cause which made them very impressive. On another occasion, Mrs. Simcoe wrote about a particularly enlightening service that she had attended. Quote, Mr. Stewart preached one of the most impressive and best sermons I had ever heard, the text, Now is the accepted time. Now is the day of salvation. Molly and Joseph Brant and the Haudenosaunee Loyalists were members of this church as well, and embraced Reverend Stewart's teachings. Molly was the only female benefactor at St. George's and was good friends with Reverend Stewart. Though he was known to have little in terms of material possessions, Reverend Stewart had much to give. He was dedicated to his teachings through both his grammar school and his church, and was passionate about the influence that a second education and spiritual footing had on the unity and cohesion of a community. His guidance and example shaped the people of Cataraqui and instilled in them a sense of solidarity, which proved to be invaluable in the War of 1812. Until his death in 1811, Reverend Stewart's political beliefs and allies did not waver, and he continued to be a strong and praised leader in Cataraqui. His son, George O'Kill Stewart, took over for him at the church while also teaching at the grammar school. Molly Brant. Molly Brant, otherwise known as Digoon Wadundi, meaning many opposed to one in Mohawk, was the sister of Joseph Brant. She played a crucial role for the Mohawks during the American Revolutionary War and was instrumental in the prosperity and enduring heritage of Cataraqui. Molly and her brother, Joseph, grew up in the home of their mother and stepfather, Nickus Brant. The identity of their biological father is debatable, as in Haudenosaunee traditions, surnames are matrilineal. Within Haudenosaunee nations, clan mothers hold decision-making power. The clan mothers are responsible for governing and tending to the primary food source, agricultural produce, with men's hunting being a supplementary source. They are also in charge of electing chiefs and voting in any economical or political affairs that arise. Molly Brant was to become clan mother, and so she was trained in Haudenosaunee traditions. She often accompanied elders on political and business trips to Europe and became well-educated in both European and Indigenous affairs. This made her an ideal representative not only for her colonial community, but also for her Haudenosaunee community especially. In approximately 1759, Molly married the British Superintendent of Indian Affairs and close friend of her stepfather, Sir William Johnson. She lived with him in Johnson Hall in New York from 1763 to 1774, where she was referred to as housekeeper by the Church of England, who refused to recognize their marriage as they were married in the longhouse. It is said that Molly's sparkling black eyes and long braided black hair is what captured Johnson's attention. Johnson was, however, involved with another woman simultaneously, Catherine Weissenberg, a German woman who worked for him and the mother of his first three children. Weissenberg died in 1759, the same year Molly gave birth to the first of eight children, who survived past infancy, that she bore Johnson. At the time, fathering children with multiple women was acceptable, especially if they could be provided for. Although Molly was alluded to as housekeeper, she was known to accomplish few, if any, housekeeping duties, but rather she assumed responsibility for organizing the various social activities that took place at Johnson Hall. She was a gracious host who welcomed all. Judge Thomas Jones describes the atmosphere in the house as open and free. After breakfast, while Sir William was about his business, his guests entertained themselves as they pleased. Some rode out, some went out with guns, some with fishing tackle, some sauntered about the town, some played cards, some backgammon, some billiards, some pennies, and some even at ninepins. Thus was each day spent until the hour of four, when the bell punctually rang for dinner and all assembled. He had, besides his own family, seldom less than 10, sometimes 30. All were welcome. All sat down together. All was good, cheer, mirth, and festivity. Each guest chose what he liked and drank as he pleased. The company, or at least a part of them, seldom broke up before 3 in the morning. Everyone, however, Sir William included, retired when he pleased. There was no restraint. Molly's amicable disposition and sincere acceptance of all who visited Johnson Hall led her to a position of prominence and influence among the Mohawk people. Her lifestyle at Johnson Hall was far from what white settlers perceived as the inferior native way of life. In fact, Molly acted more like clan mother in the household, attending to political and economic affairs, as well as stepping in to help with the daily affairs of the Indian department when Johnson was away. After Sir William Johnson died in 1774, Molly, along with her children and other loyalists, eventually fled from New York to Canada, first residing on Carleton Island, then in Cataraqui, in a home that was built for her, in recognition of her leadership and unwavering loyalty to the British. Though Molly was immersed in European culture, she adamantly insisted on dressing in customary Haudenosaunee apparel and remaining connected to her heritage. The post-revolution period saw a strict segregation between Haudenosaunee and European ethnicities in Cataraqui. At times, the Mohawks, especially women, were mocked and belittled for their traditional dress, which generally consisted of lace-up shirts, leggings, and moccasins. Molly's cultural pride and dedication to tradition remained intact. However, her brother, Joseph Brant, encouraged acculturation to the surrounding European fashion, both literally and figuratively, among his people. Molly's strong desire to resist acculturation is understandable. Mohawk women had both economic and political power to lose with the departure from a role such as clan mother, which was both acknowledged and influential among the Mohawks. Molly and Johnson's daughters, all of whom married into high society, their husbands being well-respected, well-known doctors and captains, followed Brant's lead and assumed the mannerisms and dress of their European peers. One incident in particular amplified their desire for conversion. When out in public one day in their Haudenosaunee dress, they were both verbally assaulted with derogatory remarks and innuendo by a group of young European officers. Later that evening, they encountered the same men at a formal event dressed in elegant ball gowns. The men apologized for their earlier behavior and asked them to dance in an attempt at redemption. The sisters, however, refused and left, still feeling humiliated and upset. This encounter alone is evidence of the disconnect between the two cultures. While it was perhaps not the first choice of Mohawk women to assimilate into the culture of another, it was one of the only ways that they could be viewed as educated and of higher status in a society where European culture dominated. Molly Brant, on the other hand, found a way to thrive while living between the two cultures. She remained loyal to her Mohawk heritage, yet earned the respect and recognition of her European community as well. She was a leader and a constant source of support, affirmation, and encouragement for Mohawks and Europeans alike. Though the trials of her life speak to the broader difficulties faced by Aboriginal peoples in the past, and perhaps still to an extent in the present, she played a crucial role in the endurance and progression of her people and paved the way for others to follow in her footsteps until her death in 1807. Joseph Brant. Joseph Brant, also known as Tyendinaga, was a Six Nations Mohawk chief. During the American Revolutionary War, 1775 to 1783, and after, Brant faithfully supported the British under the rule of King George III. As the political upheaval of the 13 American colonies intensified, Brant persisted and eventually in 1777 persuaded his people to break their treaty of neutrality with America and align with the British. Consequently, he relocated his people from the Mohawk Valley in present-day New York to Carleton Island, named after Sir Guy Carleton, British commander in resisting the American Revolution. Carleton Island and Fort Haldimand, named after Sir Frederick Haldimand, governor of Canada from 1778 to 1784, served as headquarters for Joseph Brant and his people, as well as loyalists, to authorize and conduct raids against the Americans in the war. The Treaty of Paris, signed in 1783, ended the American Revolutionary War between Great Britain and America and its allies. The treaty recognized Carleton Island as American territory. It was one of the many boundary settlement locations generously allocated to America by the British. In the land provisions of the treaty, however, there was no mention of Aboriginal peoples or their ownership of the land. Joseph Brant and the Mohawks were upset with the apparent disregard for their needs, as well as having to relocate yet again. This prompted Brant to seek aid from Sir Frederick Haldimand. In exchange for their unwavering loyalty to the British, Haldimand committed to finding suitable land on which they could settle. Brant claimed that the land around Fort Frontenac was rightfully theirs, as they used it as seasonal hunting grounds, though at the time, the Mississaugas were the official owners. The Crawford Purchase of 1783, named after Captain William Crawford, resulted in the Mississaugas selling the land to the British government, where it was subsequently offered to Brant and his nation. After settling in Cataraqui, Joseph Brant continued his efforts to successfully lead his nation to a peaceful and prosperous life. He often mediated issues that arose between the Mohawks and various other nations, as well as encouraged assimilation to and acceptance of the European culture that encompassed them. In 1780, after being widowed by his first two wives, Joseph would marry Catherine Croghan and have seven children with her. Catherine, unlike Joseph's sister Molly, assumed similar beliefs and ideas regarding assimilation to another culture. The family settled into a predominantly European way of life, though stayed in touch with their native heritage as well. The Crawford Purchase. The Crawford Purchase of 1783 was initiated by Sir Frederick Hallamand and is a major event in Kingston's cultural and geographic development. Recognizing that the land upon which the Mohawks wished to settle was previously occupied by the Mississaugas, Hallamand instructed that negotiations take place in an effort to make a deal with the current residents. By October of 1783, Captain William Crawford, formerly of the Royal Regiment of New York, acted on behalf of the British government and reported his success. The elderly Chief Minas of the Mississaugas had been summoned to Carleton Island, where he and company, other Onondaga chiefs, agreed to sell their land which spanned from Dunyada, or Onagara River, a tributary of the St. Lawrence below Gananoque, to a river in the Bay of Quinte, including the islands. This was in exchange for all the blankets, firearms, ammunition, and clothing as they wanted, as well as much coarse red cloth as would make about a dozen red coats and many laced hats. For many years, the Mississaugas returned to McDonald Park to receive their payment. Belle Island. Just north of downtown Kingston resides Belle Island. For an island of its size, it serves as a rich source of history regarding Kingston's indigenous past. During the Middle Woodland period, 380 to 900 AD, it was used as grounds for hunting and fishing, presumably by the Haudenosaunee. With the changing occupation of Fort Frontenac and the surrounding area, the name of the small island changed as well. For the 85 years of French occupation, the island was identified as Île aux Reculés. However, when Fort Frontenac fell to the British in 1758 and was reoccupied in 1783 by Loyalists after the American Revolutionary War, it was known as Île aux Pères. As of 1828, it appears as Belle Island. In 1988, staff of the City of Kingston Parks and Recreation were assigned the task of creating a man-made beach along the shore of Belle Island. Mechanical equipment was employed for the project and construction commenced. Shortly after beginning, however, indigenous human remains were discovered on the shore of the island. In the following year, in 1989, an official excavation of the area was begun in an effort to salvage the remains. They were carefully and respectfully collected, dated, and properly relocated to an area of the island that was better suited to burial. In addition to the human remains discovered on Belle Island, shards of pottery, remnants of early tools, and a few pipe stems were also found. The fragments of pottery were decorated with many diverse designs. There were a number of techniques used to embellish the exterior of the pots. While using various tools, the wet clay was either punctuated, stamped, cord rolled, swept, or embossed before setting, leaving subtle designs. RMC and the Aboriginal Leadership Opportunity Year. Since 2008, the Royal Military College of Canada has offered a program called the Aboriginal Leadership Opportunity Year, or ALOY. The aim of the program is to help Aboriginal Canadian youth further their academic education, learn military skills, and foster their leadership skills. It is also an opportunity for them to participate in organized athletics and develop a cultural awareness. The one-year program saw the graduation of 16 cadets on June 17, 2011, where Chief Donald Miracle, Chief of the Mohawk of the Bay of Quinte, was present. After the completion of the ALOY program, candidates are given the opportunity to apply to continue at RMC in a degree program, or they may return to their communities with the skills and abilities that they acquired from their studies at RMC, where they could be leaders among their peers. The ALOY program is an excellent opportunity for Aboriginal youth to explore the possibility of a military career, to further their education, and to inspire determination in leading a successful life. Cataraqui Native Friendship Center. The Cataraqui Native Friendship Center, located at 50 Hickson Avenue, is a member of the Ontario Federation of Indian Friendship Centers and serves Kingston and its surrounding rural areas. The center's objectives target a vast range of Aboriginal issues as diverse as the people who make up the Native community of Kingston. From problems faced by new parents to women who struggle with uniquely Aboriginal issues to those who are in trouble with the law, there are resources and support available to all. The Friendship Center emphasizes that addressing these concerns from a respectful and knowledgeable position is essential to their successful resolution. It also ensures that rights among all Native people are equal and all concerns or opinions regarding Aboriginal issues are taken into consideration when affecting change within the community. The center serves as a support system, an open forum, and a place to learn for both Natives and non-Natives alike. It strives to provide programs and services that facilitate growth and strengthen tradition among the Aboriginal community, as well as encourage respect and recognition in the non-Native population.